But of course, it is across all the papers today. The government unveiled their budget, which included an extra 4.7 billion in expenditure yesterday. And earlier, I spoke to Taoiseach Micheál Martin and started by asking him if he believes this budget will address the cost of living rises for people.
I do. I think, look, this budget can't do everything, but it certainly moves to protect people in respect of cost of living increases. And that's reflected particularly in housing, in health, education, childcare, and the various social welfare increases. If you take it all together, for many families, it represents important increases in income and reductions in charges. So charges for paediatric hospitals, increase in access to GPs up to 7 years of age for children, young people getting cheaper access to public transport, the SUSE grant and third level education being expanded. All of those measures, if you take them on the round, do help people in the current context. I think the overall point I would make, though, is that we've come through a once-in-a-century pandemic. And coming out of that, I think an extraordinary statistic is that between this year and next year, 400,000 jobs will come back to the Irish economy, which I think reflects the macroeconomic policies that we adopted, were the correct ones, were sensible, and have put the economy back on an even keel, notwithstanding that pandemic. And so we have a good chance, a good foundation to build our economy and do more next year.
Okay, let's break down some of the things you said there. You mentioned education, housing, health, childcare. Childcare, for example, a 50-cent subsidy per hour up to 45 hours per week. That probably amounts to little more than 20 euros a week for families. When we know that, particularly in urban settings, they might be paying 1,300 euros per month in a creche for one child, a second mortgage is often described as. That's not going to make a huge amount of difference in their pockets, particularly because childcare providers say that they're struggling to actually cover their own costs, that there's upward pressure on wages in that sector. And it's very likely that that subsidy will actually be, I suppose, absorbed by providers.
Well, fundamentally, I think, again, everything can't be done this year, but we did focus in on the pay of people working in the childcare sector. And we do need to improve paying conditions for people working in early education and make it attractive. And yes, the bulk of this year's funding will go towards increasing that overall pay for workers, to be determined by talks that are currently ongoing between the representatives of the workers and providers. And I think that's important because that's fundamentally will consolidate and stabilise capacity within the childcare sector because it is a big issue. And if you compare the early years to, you know, primary education or second level education, there's a clear disparity in terms of the career pathways for people. The next issue then, and the minister wants to link that to a freeze in childcare costs this year, but I would acknowledge that that in itself isn't enough and that next year we'll have to do more in terms of next year's budget to improve affordability around childcare. The state is providing well over 700 million towards childcare, but I acknowledge that it is a huge issue for many families out there. The pressing issue for providers and indeed for the system generally is to attract people into the sector and then retain them to a much improved pay environment and conditions environment.
Okay, and that sounds good. But if we talk about, say, low-paid workers, for example, I know that you've made concessions to people who have the ability to work from home. They can write off part of their utility, 30%. But the people who can work from home and usually have access to that type of, you know, blended working or hybrid working or remote working are often skilled office-based people. People in retail, people in hospitality, they don't have the option to work from home. And they're the people using childcare and indeed paying to commute, sometimes quite long distances to work. There's not much for them in this.
Well, I think the overall situation on childcare is one that I think this does represent a significant change in direction and it's going to be continued. Until we get it right in terms of both the adequacy of provision, in terms of capacity, support for parents, and there are extension of supports for parents, particularly up to 15-year-olds in various childcare settings, after-school environments and so on, and also in terms of trying to freeze at least in the immediate future any increases in the costs of childcare. I accept that more needs to be done in respect of that then once we have those issues dealt with.
But those lower paid workers who might have to drive to work if they were lucky enough to have public transport available to them, get public transport, if they aren't under 24, they're not getting the breaks that very possibly higher paid workers are who are getting those utility bills.
But the general tax stuff provides for all workers, the tax relief in the budget, For those under 35,000 in terms of the changes to the credits, and in terms of over 35s, the widening of the bands does give protection to workers, and I would argue maybe younger workers in particular, in around the 35,000-40,000 bracket. That there will be relief across the board for workers. Again, modest, because there is only so much we can do in this budgetary package. If you take in the investment in education, early to childcare, the housing aspects, the health, and much, much more, there's only so much to go around in any one year. We didn't want to overheat the economy. It is bouncing back. There is significant activity out there. Inflation is occurring globally. It's having its impact in Ireland. It would make no sense to reduce the purchasing power of people by simply overheating the economy with too much allocation.
But nonetheless, minimum wage up 30 cent, a fiver for everyone on social welfare benefits. A lot of people might accuse that of being a form of window dressing. Not enough to change people's circumstances at all. Not enough to match inflation, yet one for everyone in the audience.
Well, we have the second highest minimum wage now in Europe. Now, I accept that in terms of purchasing power, it wouldn't be as high as that, but it's still very much up there in terms of the top five or six in purchasing power in Europe in terms of the minimum wage. And we have a low pay commission, which makes an objective recommendation to government, and government has accepted that recommendation. I think the reduction in costs in healthcare will help people in low incomes in terms of access to free GP card, in terms of reducing the drug payment contribution, in terms of abolishing charges for the pediatric hospitals, in terms of abolishing charges for further education. So if you add it all up across the board, it kind of does help.
And I absolutely want to get to health. I think health and housing have always been the big crux issues for you as a government. But just before we leave, I suppose, people's pockets, you decided not to broaden the tax base. Is that a good idea, considering how indebted we are? Any shocks to our economy, it'll make us less well able to respond to them. And you also ran a smaller deficit than you could have. Was there a reason why you didn't do, I suppose, as much as possible for people in this budget?
Well, debt is now falling as a share of national income, which is a good thing. I don't think people would have seen that at the beginning of the year. There's been quite a turnaround, as you have said there. Again, it could be, so in that respect, that I think speaks to the strategy that we've adopted since the beginning of the pandemic economic, targeting resources at jobs, protecting companies and businesses, keeping them intact so that when we're coming out of the pandemic, they could have a reasonable chance of making it through and then rebuilding up again. And that seems to be working. That's why we're continuing the jobs and wage subsidies right through to April, which will help a lot of low-income workers as well in the sectors that you spoke about. I mean, that's the biggest expenditure item in this budget, well over close to $1.5 billion. And that will help workers in a lot of businesses, particularly hospitality area, arts and entertainment, which still would take some time to pick up because the pandemic is still impacting on them. So I think that needs to be taken on board as well in terms of our strategy. Now, in terms of could we have done more, there is a judgment call here in terms of overheating the economy. And we published last week the National Development Plan. That's $11 billion of a capital injection next year into the economy. And that's an economy where the private sector is now motoring in terms of domestic demand, consumer demand. And so one has to balance the degree to which the state, through overdoing it, would create an inflation spiral that would eat into people's purchasing power.
You've mentioned some of the health interventions that have come from this budget. For example, the free GP care for the 6 and 7 year olds. That's probably in and around 120,000 children, half of whom already have a medical card. So you're looking at probably about 60,000 children affected by this. Is this the right allocation of resources? We're looking at a situation where money has been thrown into the health service, but reform does not appear to be happening. Sláinte care, a lot of people would feel, is floundering, that it's moving towards just becoming a form of regionalization. We saw today there was a big study out saying medical graduates, in excess of 90% of them, said that they won't take on the public only contract that is going to be offered. It doesn't look like we're any closer to universal healthcare. It doesn't look like we're any closer to a one-tier system. Are we throwing money at it without reform? Is that now kind of the policy with healthcare, that we're not able to bring in the reforms we need, so we just pump billions into the healthcare service?
I think there has been reform. In fact, the latest report on Sláintecare actually was 97% of measures were on track and some implemented. The bed capacity, a very significant expansion of bed capacity in the last 12 months, 800 extra beds, very significant expansion of ICU beds, all in line with giving greater access for people to the public health system. And in terms of elective care, there will be proposals in terms of elective hospitals.
Still have a million on a waiting list.
But COVID has had an enormous impact here. I mean, I sometimes wonder if people have dismissed COVID as if it didn't happen. We had 5 months, and unfortunately, it has played havoc.
With I actually an take
already
that,
difficult, an I, already difficult situation in terms of the, yeah, you know, the
and
waiting
that's
list.
Fair. That's very fair. Very fair point. Yeah. And I accept that many interventions on the slow launch of care list are either in train or have been achieved. But the big one was separating public and private healthcare. The big one was offering universal access. And the big one was a single tier waiting list for people so that there wasn't this fast track. If you had money, you were going to be seen on the basis of need. And I would suggest to you that that is the big one. And we're no nearer to that one. And the rest of it is kind of dancing around the head of a pin to some extent.
You're correct that it's the big one. I don't think you're correct in saying it's something that we're nowhere near getting done. We're very focused on it. We're very determined to do it. And discussions and negotiations are underway. But the government is very clear on meeting that objective.
There's no linkage here, though, with the billions going into healthcare and achieving that.
Well, I think it relates to primary care as well, of course, and that's part of the GP, but also in terms of empowering primary care around community diagnostics, for example, and bringing a stronger community and primary care dimension to healthcare as well, also in terms of home care hours. So there's a range of measures and reforms that are required. The other big one is e-health and ICT, which health has been slow at. The system has been very slow in modernizing. The pandemic, I think, has taught a few lessons in terms of how one can modernize from a technology perspective very quickly and accelerate, which we did in vaccination programs and in other programs. And I think there's a lesson there, and we want to fast track that whole modernization and reform process around the utilization of technology in health. And that's an area that has been very slow over the years. But in terms of the single tier and people being treated in accordance with their condition, if you like, in terms of the medical situation, as opposed to anything else, that is something we're very committed to doing. It will be the most challenging part of the change and reform. You know that, and I know that. But we're still determined to do it.
Let's talk a little bit about housing, which is one of the other huge issues, I suppose, within the government. I don't want to kind of get stuck into the Housing for All plan, because that has been widely discussed in the run-up to the budget. But this, the vacant land tax, this is one of the things within the budget, and people are surprised by it. The vacant land tax up until now was 7%. It's being replaced by a new zoned land tax, which is only 3% and has a 2-year lag time before it is brought in. That 2 years gives the impression, Taoiseach, that there's no sense of urgency here. And that's what the opposition are saying. And particularly because it has been cut from 7% to 3%, you could be forgiven for thinking there's no disincentive here at all for owners not to hoard land.
That's Sinn Féin's spin now about the cut from 7 to 3, two different things completely. The Derelict Sites Act was not effective, didn't work.
That was because it was claimed it was going to be brought back by councils.
But you cannot compare it to what's now being introduced, which is quite radical and which deals with zoned land across the country. And it's quite a massive amount of zoned land that will fall to this measure in terms of any land that's owned for housing and that's serviceable will be subject to this tax. It will take time because the entire country has to be mapped. Each local authority will have to produce the maps. The revenue commissioners will be implementing it. And I think it's the real velvet revolution of the housing strategy.
Was there a reason why it was cut from 7 to 3%?
It wasn't cut. I mean, this is a new program. This is not cutting anything from 7 to 3. I mean, we're talking about hectares of land, thousands of hectares here, that's already zoned, and that up to now was never subject to any tax. The Derelict Sites Act and the Vacant Sites Act was a completely different animal to what's being envisaged here. And what basically, if people get planning permission, they're going to have to move in it now. Otherwise, they'll be taxed. And what has been happening is there has been a hoarding of land, hoping the valuation
there has, and I can accept that you might actually raise more money with this measure than you would have with the old measure.
Well, what we really want to do is we want to get more.
It's hard to see it necessarily as a disincentive. 3%.
Oh, I think it, Oh, it'll be huge.
Land inflation is higher than that.
No, I think 3% would be huge in position, given the cost and the value of the land, particularly land that's owned. It'll be huge disincentive to hoard it. In our view, and if we have to review it up, we'll do it. But the whole objective is not about raising revenue. The whole objective is about getting that land into use and to get houses built on that land. Okay. That's the agenda. And it's quite extensive. I think there's about, about 8,000 hectares zoned residential land could be impacted by this tax. That's an enormous change. And I think it will make a big difference.
Yesterday on News Talk Breakfast, we spoke to Professor John Fitzgerald about the budgetary measures that were coming in. And he was talking about the money being spent on housing. And he said that throwing money at housing isn't going to fix the problem, even if we'd like it to. We have a lack of skilled construction workers. Construction materials are in short supply and there is huge inflation around all of that. He said, actually, throwing money at this is not going to deliver houses. It's simply going to push up the cost of housing. Do you accept that?
Well, see, we're not throwing money at it. I do accept that there is a temporary inflationary cycle, or at least the ECB and others believe it's temporary. And that's why I said to you earlier, in terms of the budgetary measures, we couldn't overdo it either. We didn't want to overheat the economy. But remember, I know I have great respect for John, but the SRI then, another group of economists, recommended not so long ago that we would spend $4 billion. On housing. Government will actually allocate about $4 billion through various agencies and exchequer resources over the next 5 years per annum in respect of affordable homes, social housing, and cost rentals. So there's a variety of schemes there. The big issue will be delivery. There is a stream, we're coordinating the delivery of the Housing for All. As part of that, there's a stream that's focusing on skills, upskilling people, recruiting people, bringing people back into the country who can contribute to the construction of housing. And we do need more people involved in house construction, but that focus is there from government to get that extra capacity in.
Okay. Just moving on to climate, which is obviously another big factor that had to be considered in this budget. Obviously, the carbon tax has gone up 750 to 41 euros per tonne. Petrol and diesel going up this evening, 128 to 148. A phasing out of the 5,000 electric vehicle grant over the next couple of years. Sinn Féin say that the increase, for example, in carbon tax, that's going to do nothing for the climate, as the people don't have, I suppose, affordable green alternatives to heating their houses or perhaps access to cheap public transport. So they have to drive their old petrol and diesel cars. They say that these measures won't improve the climate and will impoverish ordinary working people. They're not necessarily wrong.
They are wrong. And it's populism and it's exploiting the climate issue. Sinn Féin is not serious about climate and never has been, from my experience over the last number of years. One cannot have a painless way to dealing with the climate challenge. It is destroying our planet. We owe to the young people and our children that we do everything we possibly can to deal with this crisis. It's an existential crisis. We do need, all the international research and evidence is that carbon taxes do work as a disincentive towards fossil fuels. But in addition to that, the government does need resources to deal with the fuel poverty side. And in fact, the switch model of the SRI will show that through the measures we've taken in this budget, notwithstanding the carbon tax, those on the three lowest income deciles will be better off as a result of the budgetary measures.
But do you accept that maybe?
But it gives us the resources to have more environmentally friendly farming. It gives us the resources to retrofit houses. And that is important because that's ultimately the best way to reduce energy costs. And again, thousands of houses next year will have the capacity to be retrofitted, to be made more energy efficient as a result of the revenue that will
come. And will that be cost neutral to those families in those houses? Because a lot of people would say they can't afford an electric vehicle, they can't afford to retrofit their houses and move to sort of a more insulated model or a greener form of wood pellets or the other types of things like solar panels. They simply don't have the money.
But there'll be various levels of contributions to help people to retrofit. And local authorities are doing retrofitting of their public housing programs, for example, and have been doing it for a while, and are continuing to do it. All of that will help us to deal with climate change, but it has to start somewhere. And this idea of it'll happen, we could do it next year, the year after, won't work. Like, it's the cumulative impact year after year. And that's why we passed the legislation last year on the carbon tax issue. It's a 10-year period. So it's provided for. It would have meant coming in and getting rid of the legislation you'd have to pass laws to get rid of it. Are Sinn Féin saying they're going to do that? Is that what they want to do? And that would set us back again. These are not easy decisions. I accept that. But there is no easy way of dealing with climate change. And I think Sinn Féin are being absolutely populist to try and pretend that there is. And I think I'm afraid they're into vote getting as opposed to saving the planet.
Taoiseach, a few other issues before I let you go. With regard to Brexit, significant distance between the EU and the UK over the Northern Ireland Protocol. EU likely to offer a set of concessions on Wednesday afternoon. Is that going to be enough to appease the UK, first of all? And also, I think a lot of people would like to know, do you think this European Court of Justice issue is a real sticking point? Is the UK acting in good faith around that? Or is it an attempt to simply apply further pressure in negotiations with the EU?
It remains to be seen whether it's a sticking point or not. I think the key point is, I'm going to pay tribute to Maros Sefcovic and the European Union Commission and President von der Leyen, whom I've spoken to right throughout the summer on this issue, because I give this huge importance because it relates to the institutions of the Good Friday Agreement, making sure we have stable, normal politics in Northern Ireland, and we need to get this issue dealt with. And people had legitimate concerns around the operation of the protocol. I met with all the parties last Friday. Maros Sefcovic, some weeks ago, met with all the parties and listened carefully. And the European Union has been responsive. European Union is in and has been in solution mode. And it takes two to tango. The United Kingdom need to get into solution mode, given the all we've gone through in terms of the Good Friday Agreement and in terms of politics on this island. There's a real responsibility on the British government to play this one straight, and to do it on the merits of the case. And the issues that people raised related to trade issues, the ease at which goods could be sent from the United Kingdom to Northern Ireland and vice versa.
Yes.
The EU listened to those concerns and are
and
taking
the, and, them and the Northern Ireland business and, community are not concerned about the European Court of Justice. And it does seem to have been kind of a red, yeah, not a red herring, but a red line.
Yeah, that would be my sense of it, because the industry and businesses in the north do get it in terms of what access to the European market means for jobs in Northern Ireland, jobs in businesses in Northern Ireland and agriculture in Northern Ireland. But access to the EU market means, obviously, ECJ has ultimate governance in terms of that access to the EU market. And people are beginning to see increased investment opportunities into Northern Ireland because of the access they currently enjoy now to the European Union market.
Do you believe that there's a real chance we will see Article 16 activated?
There's always a possibility. My sense is, having spoken to the European Union Commission, having spoken to the United Kingdom government, a fortnight ago, that they were interested in solutions and that they were going to engage with the European Union.
All right.
So it remains to be seen.
A couple of brief things. Obviously, the commemoration ceremony on the centenary of partition next week, is the government right to send representation to that, do you believe?
Yeah, I think, look, there's, to be fair, and we've said consistently the president took his decision properly, and I've been in discussions and talking to the president and so on like that, and it was very consistent with concerns he had. I think there's a distinction between the head of state and government, and the government is engaging with, as I just spoke to you in relation to the protocol, with all the parties in the north. We take the church leaders' invitation to us in good faith. This isn't commemorating anything. It's not. It's a religious service that's reflecting on the last 100 years.
They're confused why it's right for Michael D. Higgins not to go, but it's still right for Simon Coveney, Minister for Foreign Affairs, to go.
Well, as I said, there's a big distinction between the head of state and the government, and there's different prisms to which both institutions have to look at an issue like this. And as I said, we've continued our outreach to the tradition in Northern Ireland, or the different traditions in Northern Ireland, different communities and different political parties. And it's in that context of ongoing relationships that we've decided to take on board the invitation that the religious leaders have sent to the government as a government to be represented. But I think I'd make the point, I don't think this should be a divisive issue. I was struck that Sinn Féin would have attended the exact same type of ceremony in September with the exact same language around the invitation to them to attend that particular event at the Presbyterian Church, which they did. So I find it difficult to comprehend why they're making such a big deal of it now. And I think we just need to continue the level of engagement that we have as a government with the political parties in the north. My main agenda in terms of the north at the moment is resolving the protocol issue. And I'm engaging with all the political parties along with Simon Coveney in that respect. The next 6 weeks to 2 months are very important in that regard. Okay. I've been very consistent since I became Taoiseach that I want to maintain the institutions of the Good Friday Agreement, keep them intact, and then roll out the Shared Ireland agenda. We've another $500 million have been allocated now on the National Development Plan to the Shared Ireland. That's $1 billion. There's peace funding of $1 billion to be spent. We need the North-South Ministerial Council in place to allocate those resources for the benefit of the people in Northern Ireland. And that's what my agenda is.
Lastly, two very brief things. One, COVID cases, the highest number of cases that we've seen since March, the highest number of hospitalizations, ICU cases. We're only a week and a half out from the easing of almost all restrictions. Will we see that happen even if this trend continues, cases and hospitalizations climb?
We're on track to do what we said we would do on the 20th, thereabouts. I am concerned about the impact of the current wave on our hospital services because they're under a lot of stress and strain. And to be fair, those working in our hospitals have got very little respite since the beginning of the pandemic early in 2020. That said, I think the vaccination has been powerful against the virus in terms of severe illness, hospitalization and death. And I think now that we've commenced the booster program, I think on balance, we're in a good position. But we are keeping an eye on it, and I'll be engaging further with the Chief Medical Officer and others in NPHET in respect of where we are now in terms of the overall prevalence of the disease. But I spoke last week to the CMO, and you know he was in a relatively
no change of plan foreseen at the moment.
Yeah, obviously there's concern, but you know the numbers haven't gone down either, and notwithstanding our enormous and high vaccine rate.
And very lastly, not a great showing for Fianna Fáil in last week's Irish Times poll, support of about 20% of the electorate. Sean Fleming says it's because you've become too middle class. Is he right?
Well, first of all, you know, I'm not a great believer in polls, but that poll is only 2% off our general election poll. And our general election poll had us as the largest political party in Dáil Éireann. So I think there's too much negativity about Fianna Fáil generally in commentary. That's a view I have. People seem to be obsessed with Fianna Fáil more than any other party, but there you are. But I don't agree with Sean on that. I think we have a strong working class support base. I accept that definitions nowadays of what's working class, what's middle class can vary. But many of our party supporters, many of the party members, and it was interesting at our thinking, the number of TDs and those who came from working class backgrounds was very high. They articulated why they joined Fianna Fáil. They said Fianna Fáil is the party that built the houses in the past. They gave opportunities to people in education through free second level education and a massive expansion of third level. And that always looked after the elderly and the less well off in society. And that continues to be our esprit de corps. You know.
View you as Fine Gael light at the moment?
Not at all. Look what's happening in housing. You know, dramatically transformed state intervention in housing over the last year and a half in terms of the Housing for All strategy.
Fianna Fáil's influence?
Very strongly in Fianna Fáil's impact. Education, we're having a very strong impact. We have a new Department of Higher Education and research at my instigation from a policy perspective. And Simon Harris is doing a very good job there. Again, you know, Fianna Fáil has always been the party that believed in education as a great enabler in society, the great creating opportunities for people irrespective of background. That's always been the hallmark of our party and something that
I'm passionately committed to.
If you take special education today, like 1,100 special needs assistants, close to 1,000 extra teachers, the majority in special needs education. I mean, that's something that I've been committed to all my political life. And I'm glad to see that we're continuing to make progress.
And despite those values, despite Sean Fleming saying you're too middle class, are you surprised that Sinn Féin, therefore, have a higher support base among affluent voters in this country than Fianna Fáil?
But I mean, you can't have a both.
Well, I'm wrong. It was Fianna Fáil who's called Fianna Fáil too middle class. Sinn Féin could be just as middle class, if not more.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me in some respects, because Sinn Féin will play all the aces. No, I think I'm not fazed by any of this, because the real polls will what determines the the story. The last general election, we emerged as the largest party. We would have liked to have done better. We should have done better. And, you know, we've had a very good evaluation of that. We've learned lessons from that. But I think you need to be very careful about interpreting polls. And I think one of the problems of political commentary, if I may say so, has been the over-obsession with polls. And they shape the context in which politics gets discussed. And I think that's wrong. I think we should continue to discuss the issues, which you have, in fairness, throughout this interview. But I think the polls have an overbearing influence in political commentary more generally. And that's just a view I've had for the last 10 years. And they shape all of the discussions as to, you know, who goes in with who and who will go in with who, instead of focusing on the substance of policy. I think what's happening at the moment is that Sinn Féin has become very populist. You know, the last general election, I mean, they're promising billions. They opposed the tax cuts today, fair enough, that young people would have benefited from and middle-income groups will benefit from. But they're generally, on carbon tax, on the COVID, they're extraordinarily populist, you know. 1 month they were saying, let everybody fly. The next month they wanted zero COVID. They wanted, you know, the whole range of, I can go through all the inconsistencies, but it was the wind was blowing, you know.
Talking about who would go in with who, lastly, would you go in with them if the numbers tallied up?
There you go again now. Our view is very clear. We're going to focus now. We're in government with the Green Party and with Fine Gael. We're very focused on implementing this programme for government, which we're doing well. I mean, you take the last 6 weeks alone, you know, National Development Plan produced, the corporation tax issue skillfully landed, a very difficult period over the last 9 months, getting that in the right shape to maintain our competitiveness as an economy, the Housing for All strategy produced, a budget now produced, and the Climate Action Plan in another couple of weeks. This is a government that's very competent, that's dealing with the substance of the challenges that face us. We're dealing with all of that just as we've emerged from a one-in-a-century pandemic. I would say that any objective reading of it is that the government is doing well, relatively speaking, in the context of huge challenges.
On that note, Taoiseach Micheál Martin, thank you very much for speaking to News Talk Breakfast.